evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. A few weeks ago, we discussed what are now becoming increasingly unsettling times, as well as other monumental times in our recent history. As waves of protest continue to sweep through our nation's college campuses, streets and bridges, monuments, and during special events, they also are taking place within our workplace, as well as conduct outside the workplace at times finds its way within the workplace. Protesting, engaging in free speech, is considered a protected political activity in California, whether the topic is war, immigration, body autonomy, a November ballot initiative, or another political issue here or even abroad. Ensuring one's right to free speech is one of our core tenets of our democracy. In California, there are laws that limit the extent to which your employer may interfere with your right to engage in political activities, but your specific rights as a worker who engages in a political protest and the extent that employer may interfere with your rights to engage will depend on your situation and when, how, and where you decide to protest. Tonight in Your Legal Rights, with participation and assistance of the Labor and Employment Law section of the California Lawyers Association, we are resuming our discussion about protests in the workplace, labor and employment law in an unsettled and evolving world. While our last discussion was broad and general, tonight we're bringing in more specific instances, more issues, and as always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about protests, you want to talk about your job. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. But do bear in mind, our guests can't provide you precise legal advice. They don't have all the facts relating to your given case. But we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And the guidance given by our guests mightn't be the same positions of their respective clients, their employers, or KALW. But again, we're all here to help. And with that, I'm excited to welcome back Wendy Mussel and Beth Mora to Your Legal Rights, where we will continue the discussion with Wendy and Beth that I began on the July 3rd, 2024 broadcast on political activity and your workplace rights. Tonight, we'll discuss several workplace political activity situations, actual matters that occurred with our guests, which will help illuminate the nature of your workplace rights as a political protester while holding down a job in California. With that, Beth, Wendy, let me welcome you back to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Jeff.
You know, the last month we began with what sounded like a simple question. Does my First Amendment right have limits? Does it end at my employer's door or when my worldview differs from my employer's? Would one of you like to tackle that and kind of give us a simple answer?
I'll tackle that and give Wendy a short break. There is no simple answer, but there are some basic foundational ground rules. There is a right, a fundamental right to free speech in our Constitution. However, despite very popular misunderstanding, there is no fundamental right to free speech in the workplace.
Let me jump in for 1 second. Most people don't understand this concept, and that is the Constitution is a contract between you as an individual and your government. It limits what the state can do. It limits what the federal government can do. It's not designed to be a contract between you and your employer any more than your next door neighbor or anyone else. With that in mind, First Amendment doesn't apply to your employer?
Depends who your employer is. So if you're an employee of the public entity, so if you're employee, if you're engaging in speech and the workplace is a public entity, if you're public, federal, state, local government entities are generally protected speech. If you are a private citizen speaking at a public concern in a public entity. Different if you are a public employee, an employee of a private employer. It's a very different setting. There's no general right of free speech in a private employer setting. There's more limitations a private employer can make in those settings. For example, under the Labor Code or National Labor Relations Act.
So if I work for a public employer, I work at a city hall, I may have some very different recourse than if I work down the street in an office building.
That's exactly right. Beth covered it exactly correctly, that when you, for example, are employed by the federal government, the state of California, if you're employed by a city, a school district, for example, you have greater rights for free speech in the workplace than you do as a private citizen working for a private employer. And so private employers, as Beth indicated, can have limits as to your speech in the workplace, particularly political speech, so long as it's neutrally applied. So, for example, let's say I was a huge proponent of the Green Party and I just keep wanting to talk about let's make the country green again. and I just continue to talk about that sloganeering and why it's so important that we vote for a particular candidate and their particular platform. And I'm doing that at a private workplace. An employer can say, knock it off, you can't do that, but not if they allow the same kind of discussion to occur about other political parties other than the Green Party, for example. So if they allow a lot of discussion about Republicans or Democrats and similar political speech and that gets unregulated in the private workplace, but I'm dinged for wanting to make America green again, that would not be permitted.
We had a caller last time that claimed to be an employee of the city of San Francisco, worked, I believe he was public works, engaged in a protest, an activity that wasn't even within the city, much less in the city limits, but was also drove there in a marked city-owned vehicle. It starts to get complicated, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. Your employer can't generally ding you for protests that occur not on work time. Unless, for example, you're in particular positions such as a peace officer, or let's say you're a doctor, those may bring up different concerns if you're engaging in protests on non-work time. There can be some regulation, for example, of peace officers, let's say they're engaged in certain kind of protests that are deemed to be hate speech. Those could be regulated by their department and result in discipline. But generally speaking, your off-duty time is your own to engage in protesting unless it otherwise has an impact upon the employer's business. Or, for example, you're not showing up for work because you're going to the protest, or in this case, you're using a work vehicle related to the protest. And then, of course, you look at whether or not individuals are treated similarly. Is a person disciplined who uses a work truck to go to the grocery store versus to go to a protest? Then you would look at, well, if you're only getting dinged for going to a protest but not to the grocery store using a work vehicle, that starts to look a lot like you're being disciplined for going to a protest.
What if I'm wearing a uniform? I'm a custodian for this city, and I'm wearing a uniform that identifies the city and clearly has all the trappings of the city. Are there limits on what I can do after work? Is it as simple an issue of maybe I should change my clothes before I go out and engage in uproarious conduct?
It's the same thing that Wendy just covered, whether or not it's the company car, or the corporate, the city truck. It's the city identifying materials. There has to be a standard policy and has to be applied equally and fairly to everyone. But really, let's just use some common sense, like change out of the identifying material and not use the big county truck or wearing the county gear is always just kind of smart common sense. But if you do that conduct, then you have to look at the policy and ensure that it's equally and fairly applied to everyone.
You know, there's a flip side to that, a mirror image issue. Some of the big cases in this field seem to have been happening in this region. It's amazing to me how much of a spotlight has been on this region for such things. One of the cases that we were going to talk a little bit about had somebody at Whole Foods working while wearing some of the protest insignia. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Wendy, you want to go first?
Sure. That's a fascinating case, I find. And it looks like the National Labor Relations Board and the courts came out in different ways as it relates to this topic. So for those that don't know, there was big cases where employees of Whole Foods were wearing Black Lives Matter materials, either masks or other insignia, while they are working. And Whole Foods indicated that that was a violation of their uniform or look policy, and folks would have to leave work. And if they got so many dings for leaving work, they could be disciplined and fired. The NLRB indicated just simply raising issues of Black Lives Matter was not sufficiently connected to the working conditions of the workplace in order to be protected, and those employees were rightfully fired. However, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal court that's located on the East Coast, found opposite and reinstated a case of an individual who was fired who was wearing Black Lives Matter insignia and also raising issues of discrimination in the workplace at Whole Foods. So this is an area to watch. It's very interesting how these came out in different ways.
Let me turn it to Anwar from Daily City. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi.
So me and some friends, we were protesting a few months back over at State. And we decided we weren't going to let the Jews into a few buildings, and you know, because we're protesting over Israel and Gaza, and they had surveillance cameras and took pictures, which is why we wear masks, because we don't want anybody to know who we are. So anyway, what we did was we locked arms. And, you know, if somebody wearing a skull cap or, you know, if somebody we thought was Jewish tried to enter the building, we'd shove them away and say, there's no Jews today. And somebody said that they're taking pictures because we're not allowed to do that kind of protesting. And I thought this was a free country, so I want to know what the deal is on that. And they're, you know, talking about calling my boss and, you know, saying that I'm some kind of bigot.
Well, in terms of, so let's take this piece by piece. You are entitled to protest. However, if you have issues, you know, regarding war or concerns regarding, you know, politics, either here or abroad. However, speech is limited by hate speech and discrimination laws. And so it's similar, if you remember, where African Americans were not allowed into public spaces simply based on their race. It's exactly the same thing. If you're indicating no Jews allowed, that's similar to saying an individual from any other protected class are not allowed, particularly if there's any sort of physical touching that can be considered a hate crime. It can be assault, battery. You could also find that there are other charges that, although I'm not a criminal law expert, I'm sure Jeff could talk a lot more about that than I could. But in any event, the protest, simply protesting issues in Israel or Gaza, depending upon the actions, that's perfectly acceptable. But when you move into physical touching of individuals or assault or refusing to allow them to enter into buildings or places of public accommodation based on their protected status, such as their fact that they're Jewish, then that walks into an entirely different area, which would be prohibited by law.
The only other thing I wanted to flag for that, the question, which I thought was a valid question, is can they take your picture? And that's something that's come up more and more recently. If you're outside in public, do you have an expectation of privacy? If you're at a protest in public, it sounds like if you say state, you're at a state campus or state university, that's probably a public space. If you're outside at public in a public protest, it's unlikely that in that setting there is any expectation of privacy. So it's not unlikely that someone can take your picture. What they can do with that and how it can be used is another completely different issue. There's all sorts of stalking rules and so forth. And so I couldn't say what comes of that. It depends if the conduct actually rises to the level of activity that they can use the picture for something or not. But there shouldn't be an expectation of privacy in a public space where you're engaging in a protest on especially public land, where there likely is cameras as well. So I would expect that your picture is being taken.
A couple things I want to throw in too. One of them is you heard me say maybe 10 minutes ago that the Constitution tends to be a pact between you and your government and not you and your neighbors, your employer, or anyone else. For the most part, that would be true. One notable exception, the rules against discrimination stem from the abolition of slavery. They go back to the 13th, 14th Amendments, and those are one arena where it does reach private conduct, which you bring up in what you were doing. The other thing I wanted to mention is the moment you go hands-on, the moment you stop somebody from going from one place to another, you are engaging in conduct that's criminalized within California on a number of grounds, whether it's the physical contact does not have to be enough to hurt somebody. If it's offensive and unwanted touching, it's a battery. And it ramps up from there. If you take somebody from one place to another, or stop somebody from going from one place to another, you could be looking at a kidnapping or a false imprisonment, even with conduct that may appear to be warranted or innocuous. Tread lightly.
Well, and you know, go ahead, sorry.
They're not equal.
Say again?
Where I come from in Lebanon, they don't go out of their way to protect the Jews like regular people.
Well,
discrimination laws in California and nationally, we cover both race, national origin, and religion. So individuals who are Jewish, individuals who are Muslim, individuals who are Buddhist, Christian, all protected. And so here in California, in the United States, we are very lucky to have excellent discrimination protections, as well as nationally, and that includes based on religion. So individuals who are Jewish are absolutely covered, and prohibiting individuals from entering into public accommodations based on their protected status, whether they're a woman, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Muslim, all of that would be prohibited. It's part of the history of the United States. Unfortunately, we did have separate but equal. So if you can imagine the same thing, if you're going to have separate but equal, where Jews can't go into stores, hotels, accommodations, same thing that we've already rejected, put into the dustbin of history where it belongs. One of the interesting issues that you did bring up, though, is if your employer was contacted about you engaging in a protest and you were arrested. I know that's not what you said, but let's assume you had been. Then that raises a number of really interesting issues about whether or not your employer can take into account simply your arrest as to whether or not they can discipline you. And so for that issue, generally speaking, you're considered to be, not guilty until there's some adjudication of that matter. And so your employer couldn't, generally speaking, take actions against you unless, for example, let's say you're wearing a work shirt while you engaged in this or otherwise identified yourself from a particular employer, or if you were, let's say, a peace officer where it would impact your day-to-day work. But simply engaging in conduct that you're arrested but there's no adjudication, you couldn't then be fired for that. I also just very briefly want to say that we have labor code protections under California law that prohibit employers from, generally speaking, from firing you, discharging you, threatening to discharge you for engaging in political activity. Now, there's a difference between political activity and criminal assault, and so that's something that would have to be, in this particular situation, evaluated.
But do tread lightly. Well, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And before we move on, I was looking at the case involving the Black Lives Matter at the Whole Foods workplace. Isn't there some action that the employer can take, not necessarily because of the politics involved, but just because this person is displacing part of their dress code or uniform in order to make a point? Or is their speech protected where the requirement for the uniform has to give way?
Well, that's a fascinating question, because you had the National Labor Relations Board went one way and the court system went the other. I think one of the major things that employers really need to think about is it a neutral policy? So let's say I have a uniform policy, I'm an employer, and I say you can't wear any insignias, but I allow other insignias, but I don't allow Black Lives Matter. But maybe I allow Blue Lives Matter. Maybe I allow particular political speech. Maybe I allow other utterances of protected classes, but simply not based on race. And I prohibit those based on race. I think you're going to run into a problem as an employer if that's the position you take. If you're going to have a uniform policy, it has to be dealt with uniformly, meaning you can't pick and choose what political messages you agree with or don't agree with. Now, of course, hate speech is something else. So if you had a pin with some of the language of the last caller, I think you could find yourself very easily disciplined or discharged. But if it's a Black Lives Matter pin and an employer discharges an employee for that, but they don't discharge an employee for other pins, such as LGBT rights, for example, I think you're going to have some issues. Although that was a concern in mm-hmm. the Whole Foods case, where Whole Foods did allow, for example, pins having to do with gay pride, as well as some other months dedicated to particular protected classes, allowed those, but disciplined folks for Black Lives Matter. That's why I think that this is going to be a case to watch. How that shakes out across the country with the same facts.
Yeah, and actually it's a really interesting ultimate outcome in the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board outcome, is the judge ultimately said there that it wasn't that he didn't ultimately say like there wasn't race at issue, wasn't it that he didn't find this a compelling argument. He ultimately said that yes, they argued the LGBTQ rights movement issues were happening there. He said that he felt the employer, that there was evidence persuaded me that the employer was merely trying to avoid controversy and conflict at the stores which it believed the BLM messaging would invite. And that reason, that the court there deemed, the NLRB deemed that as a justification to dismiss that there. And there's not as many rights of appeal in that setting. So now it's really in the court setting outside of the appellate, outside of the NLRB setting. So we're going to see two very different outcomes as this thing moves forward. And it's really important for everyone to watch because it is right on point with what we're dealing with now.
So if the employer was strictly requiring people to adhere to a dress code that was completely content neutral, you wear the company uniform, company shirt or blouse, company slacks, no messages of whatsoever, they're probably on more solid ground then than they would be if you're allowing variants from the uniform and then saying, wait, this goes too far with a certain
That's
message.
Exactly right. That's exactly right, Jeff. So the only other examples that are protected by law that I can think of off the top of my head is there are accommodations for religious beliefs and observations in the workplace. And those are covered under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, as well as California's Fair Employment and Housing Act. So, for example, if I wear a headscarf because I'm Muslim, then an employer can be required to accommodate me, even though they have a uniform policy. Or if I wear a yarmulke, for example, or if I have facial hair because I'm sick, for example, those are all accommodations based on religion that an employer would have to consider and provide unless it was an undue hardship. And there's a number of cases in the California Supreme Court and U.S. Supreme Court supporting those rights.
And this is an interesting area because it's also First Amendment. The practice of your religion is First Amendment. But at the same time, it may come out with a different outcome because a discriminatory practice has a constitutional basis for a private employer or a private anybody to face some action based on discrimination.
Yes, that's also a fascinating area that both Beth and I have seen, where you have the confluence of the rights of individuals based on religion and where that hits the rights of other people, generally LGBT folks, in non-discrimination policies with the employer. And it can go both ways. There can be negative comments made by people of faith, by individuals who are working in a company that can be found to be discriminatory. Or you can have individuals who are of a particular faith in the workplace indicating, anti-LGBT sentiment that could violate non-discrimination policies and law. And I personally find that confluence fascinating about where one right ends and the others begin and how courts are evaluating that.
In a moment, we're going to break for a station ID, and when we come back, I want to shift gears. We were talking about some of the important cases and how they arose out of right here, and we have one that talks about do no harm, and when it comes to war protests, and when it comes to war itself, coming from right here out of UCSF. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area, where we will be back right after this.
Thank you, Jeff. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616, that's 415-989-1616, or visit sfbar.org for more information. Now back to Jeff and his guests for Your Legal Rights.
And you are listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're discussing protests and the workplace, labor and employment law in an unsettled and evolving world. My guests, Wendy Musil from Wendy Musil PC and Beth W. Mora of Mora Employment, and they're here to help. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You want to talk about protesting, you want to talk about your job, you want to talk about free speech, where these things come together, give us a call. You don't have to jump in at the exact point we may be in our conversation, which is about to shift gears a little bit. One of the hot button places is right here at UCSF, where we had some question about the confluence of free speech, protesting, and the oaths people take when they're working in medicine. Who'd like to chat a little bit about that?
Well, I'm happy to talk about it a little bit. UCSF Medical Center is where you have employees, doctors, students, and patients. It is also a public employer workplace. So you've got multiple different crossovers of important different rights happening. Because it is also a public workplace, it is also like when we've been talking about police officers with that heightened duties and heightened workplaces. It is one of those other settings where you're providing healthcare with patients and safety at issues. It's one of those settings where we look at free speech just a bit differently. But again, just like when we've been talking about public employers and public settings, it has that other confluence, and also education. And in that setting, there's been some allegations, and we'll be very clear, nothing's been proven. These are all allegations that are in the news. There's just been some allegations of comments made and actions engaged that some have assumed, have said that are anti-Semitic towards Jewish doctors. And some have argued that they have felt unsafe or attacked, and that there's been protests and then encampments. And apparently there's been complaints, even by patients. The question then becomes, is there a heightened duty to address that for the safety of patients? And there's been a lot of discussion about it. And this is one of the first medical facilities that I've seen, that doesn't mean there's not more, that has recently received questioning from the federal government in a letter dated July 31st of this year from the House Energy Commerce Committee. It's from three Republicans on the committee, setting a list of questions that they want answered about what's happening at the university. Doesn't mean it's true or verified. They're just looking into it. But it's because the setting is a bit different and it's more unique than you have when you have just a workplace because of those overlaps of whether or not health and safety is at issue.
And it's kind of interesting because sometimes the expressions of the people working in that environment would give real pause to the patients about just how safe they are in that facility.
Well, and that has been some of the feedback that have been in the press. Apparently, of course, I don't know if it's true, right? Apparently patients have complained about feeling unsafe. Apparently some doctors have felt they're unsafe. And I don't know exactly what they're complaining about, I hear the complaint is that medicine should be absent of political views. I understand where they're coming from, just like we would want our officers to be absent of political views. So when they call and they show up, if you need help, you don't want your doctor or your police officer or anyone doing first responder emergency treatment to not want to talk to you because you voted Republican and they're Democrat or any of these things. They shouldn't interfere with the health and safety that anyone's offering. And I think that's what the big concern is right now, is people are saying that this is where is the First Amendment and these health and safety concerns is where they interweave and it becomes a problem. And it's one of the first times we've seen this issue really come to the forefront. And law is really struggling with it, because you want to honor people's right to free speech, but you want to honor and ensure that there's not discrimination, and you want to make sure patients and everyone is safe. And this is really the first time we've seen it develop in such an extreme way in the press.
I think this is a fascinating area, as Beth has described, where you have individuals making life and death decisions. And if they've made comments that could be construed as discriminatory or hate speech, and if there's negative medical consequences for any particular patient, I would be deeply concerned looking at whether those belief systems has affected their medical care. So I think that hospitals are really going to have to look very closely at that and look at the risk that they run, where you, if you have doctors indicating, for example, that they don't wish to have the presence of particular individuals from various religions in the workplace, I think that could be a real problem for the hospital if there's a medical malpractice claim, for example, also for discrimination claims from other coworkers in the workplace. If you allow the sort of speech that's been reported in the news, I think it can really run afoul of the discrimination policies in state and federal law. This is one to watch as to where the rights for free speech and the non-discrimination rights, where those meet and how the courts are going to shake this out. I think we're going to be talking about this in years to come. I would be surprised if there wasn't substantial litigation coming out of this from various quarters.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure we watch. It's the overlap between free speech, anti-discrimination, and health of safety in patients. And it's the same in the police setting. It's the right of the employer, right of the employee, and the health and safety of those that they serve. These are intense overlaps, and the employer has a duty, the provider has a duty to provide safety. And is that speech more important than the safety of the people they serve?
And of course, this is a natural hotbed for this particular time and this particular issue, because let's face it, because of many years or generations of tradition, you have a pretty disproportionate population of both Jews and Muslims in healthcare, particularly as doctors. So you're going to see stuff like this come out there in areas that it might not. It's grossly exaggerated from what you would see in other industries.
Well, I think it's also interesting about patients who are trying to enter into these medical facilities having to run the gauntlet of various what they could construe as hate speech and whether they're safe as a patient, regardless of whether it's deemed to be anti-Muslim sentiment or anti-Semitism. I think those raise some serious concerns about patient safety and whether the employer here is providing a safe space for their employees and patients to enter and leave the building, and where the proliferation of speech happens while there's healthcare happening. As Beth has indicated, I think this is going to be a really interesting one to watch. And I think liking it to peace officers is an apt analogy.
Let me turn it to Carolyn and Woodacre on line one. Carolyn, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment. Very good show and very much social aspects that we need to watch. I wanted to comment on about the doctors and whether items were discriminatory or not. And I think this is a topic to watch, because what I have found is we have these extremes of your previous caller when we were talking about, he was saying about not allowing Jews. I'm not Jewish, but I find what he said offensive, that he would decide who's Jewish, who's not allow them into buildings. So that is quite obviously discriminatory, just as it would be to not allow a black or an Asian or a white person into a building. But with the doctors, I think what we have is a problem, because I have several friends who do work at UCSF. And what's happening is that there are internal memos going around and internal recommendations about what's going on with Israel and Gaza. And, of course, everybody has different views on that. So what I understand from my friends who work there is that it's become a very black and white issue, where if you support a ceasefire or you object to what's happening in Gaza or the West Bank with the settlers terrorists or the Hamas terrorists in Gaza, then you somehow are being anti-Semitic. And then you do have people who are openly anti-Semitic, which is wrong too. So I think this is a very difficult situation for employers. And I don't know where the compromise is. I don't know, that comes down to law and all of that, and labor law and federal law about discrimination. I mean, it is a topic for us to continue to talk about. I mean, where is the line? Where does hate speech start and where does it end? That was
Caroline, question. Yeah, no, Caroline, I appreciate you saying that so much. It is so wonderful that you're willing to say it, you're willing to talk about it. We should be talking about it. We should be having healthy conversations. People shouldn't be, I hate using the term, canceled for sharing and listening and talking and learning. But the question I think happening at UCSF, which you have alluded to, is that a conversation for healthcare when people are trying to work and trying to get health care and treatment, for example, if someone's going for chemotherapy or radiation or surgery, and they're hearing it? And I think that's the debate that's happening about whether or not that type of speech is or is not appropriate in that setting because of the type of setting that's happening. But I also want to separate what you're saying also is those conversations should be happening and people shouldn't get in trouble for having them, is of whether or not it's a healthcare setting or not. And so you bring up two excellent points, and I so commend you for doing it and doing it beautifully.
Well, I do think that the question is, what is appropriate work behavior and what is like the dialogue we're having? This has nothing to do with either. Well, it has to do with your profession, but not with mine. And so there is a fine line there. And I think a lot of the issue in our society is we don't know how to politely disagree with each other. We don't know how to politely listen to someone that doesn't have the views that we have. You know, as I said, I found what the young man was saying about he's not going to let Jews in the building type of thing, I found that offensive, even though I'm not Jewish. So there's a lot of that kind of talk, but we need to be able to have that kind of talk. And unfortunately, I don't know why we can't, but I don't think in the workplace that is appropriate, whether it be healthcare, my profession of engineering, whatever. You know, it's just, the workplace is the workplace.
Thank you, Caroline.
End of my comment.
Caroline, thank you. You illustrated it beautifully and brought out the concerns, and I think you're spot on. Exactly right. Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Let me turn it to Julia in Pacifica. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. My name is Julia, and I'm calling from Pacifica. And I was wondering if Wendy could talk a little bit about, or maybe you've already discussed this, maybe I tuned in late, about I think it was the Bolden Harge decision about loyalty oaths. And
yes.
One thing that I'd like to say about that is, like, a lot of people don't know the history of the loyalty oath in education and how the Levering Act, and how that relates to the McCarthy era, and how every single educator is required to sign a loyalty oath, and how this accommodation is not freely available online, and what can be done to anybody that's renewing their teaching credentials, that they're still forced to sign this loyalty oath that has its roots in silencing the freedom of speech under and intimidation of outspoken university professors and educators during the McCarthy era. So go ahead and talk about loyalty oaths, the Bolton Hodge decision, and how that applies to educators.
Well, Julia, I'm so glad you called. I have the great fortune to represent Ms. Bolton Hodge in a case against the state of California, where she is Jehovah's Witness, and she, although she had already worked for the state of California, the state of California does require a loyalty oath. And for many people of different faiths, loyalty oaths is against the tenets of their faith, where their first loyalty is to God, and they cannot provide the sort of loyalty oath that was, as Julia quite rightly indicates, is a product of the McCarthy era. That's not something that was required prior to that. So we won at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals the right to continue with the case, and that having a state law that indicates that there is a requirement for a loyalty oath does not in and of itself mean that you cannot pursue a case under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So meaning that you still have your rights for religious accommodation in the workplace, even if you work for the state of California. And so that case continues. We're very happy with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, very proud of it. And I just also want to acknowledge that the Stanford Law School Religious Liberty Clinic is co-counsel in that case, and they do a fantastic job representing people of all faiths. In my own practice, I've represented people of all faiths, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, evangelical Christian. I think the only case I haven't represented an individual is Buddhist. For some reason, I don't get
Unitarian.
I think I have gotten a call from an individual who's Unitarian. But in any event, we're very happy with the decision, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to set law that individuals who need an accommodation for the loyalty oath, who work in public employment, as it indicates under Title VII and the EEOC guidance, will be able to actually perform work.
Now you mentioned something about you spoke about the case as if it's not done. Are they appealing it, or is it resolved?
I know this is getting a little inside baseball, but the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had reversed the dismissal of the case, reinstated the case, and it is continuing. Although the Ninth Circuit, I encourage people who are interested in loyalty oaths, learning more about what came out of the McCarthy era and the fact that the public employment often does require you to sign a loyalty oath. A lot of people are surprised at that. That is a requirement, and you do, if you need an accommodation based on a religion, do have a legal basis to request one. This doesn't, of course, mean that you wouldn't follow all the policies or procedures or the Constitution of the United States, nor the state constitution. It simply means that you should be able to be a person of religious faith and still be able to perform your job. One question, which is separate from the Bolton Hodge case, whether we should have loyalty oaths, given that they're a product of the McCarthy era. That's a question for another day, although it was given a lot more breath of life after January 6th. Folks have looked at that a bit differently. So that's an area of public employment where you look at the rights of individuals for religious accommodation versus the requirements of the state for the job, and whether or not those can be accommodated.
I have a specific question about the California Teaching Credential Commission. I've been trying to negotiate with them to opt out of the loyalty oath for well over a year now, and although they will grant me some accommodation, it's unequal. I cannot go online, and it's not. It's also that this accommodation is done in secrecy. It's not available to anyone else. They don't know about it. It's a hidden accommodation. Now, is that kind of a cloistered, I mean, is that a real accommodation if it's not equally available to all comers?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the things that employers, public employers in particular, really ought to make sure is, and all employers, is that their policies have transparency, particularly related to non-discrimination employment. Of course, part of non-discrimination employment includes religious accommodations as well as disability accommodations, of which accommodations for the loyalty oath would fall under.
So they would need to make that publicly they would need to make that public knowledge to be equitable, wouldn't they?
Well, there's no law that says that, let's say, UC has to send to all of us their policies, although they should have them available. As an example, often you can find the policies of public employees on their website. But again, this is an interesting topic as to what's the rights for public employees versus what's the rights for private employees, just bringing this back to our conversation and the right to free speech.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it possible for me to contact you to get more opinions from you on this matter?
We are always happy to talk to folks about their legal rights, and we appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and actually, a great segue for one of these things that Wendy was talking about with the loyalty oath, and we think about it for public employers. One of the things that, and when we were talking about protests and things that we were talking about earlier, is under the labor code, which limits the ability of an employer to discipline someone for engaging in protesting in certain ways, it is important to understand that there is nothing that protects someone if they do engage in political protesting that promotes or advocates for the overthrow of the U.S. government by force or violence. So an employer can discipline people for that. And that's one of the examples we could have talked about today. We don't know, you need to get into detail, but this happened a lot after the insurrection. There was multiple people who got terminated after they took a day off and went to the Capitol and engaged in insurrection behavior, posted about it on social media, and then were wondering why they got terminated. Well, maybe they violated the policy. Maybe they falsified why they took the day off, all sorts of reasons. But that is actually not protected political activity if it is argued to be conduct that promoted or advocated for the overthrow of the U.S. government. Like that segue, campers.
That's an excellent point, Beth. Under the labor code as well as federal law, that's absolutely a limitation. You can't engage in violent conduct or overthrow of the government and expect that to be protected activity.
So we have but a few minutes left, and I'd like to move into a couple of other cases that we were talking about before we went on the air. One of them has nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with protesting, but involves employees who were liking posts that were adverse to the employer. And it didn't have the outcome that one would have expected. Who'd like to chat a little bit about that case?
Are you talking about Triple Play Sports?
That I am. That I am.
That is a great, fun case. Is it a former employee posted on Facebook? Maybe someone should do the owners of Triple Play a favor and buy it from them. They can't even do their tax paperwork correctly. No, now I owe money. WTF. Other employees liked this post, calling the employer an a-hole. Employees were then fired. And then they filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Act. And ultimately, they were all hired back, because it was deemed concerted activity, engaging in activity that were about the terms and conditions of employment, wages, hours, terms and conditions of employment, even if it was during non-work hours and in non-work areas.
But wouldn't you think that an employer might be able to do something if an employee was going on to Facebook post, sending stuff out to the public that says, "My employers," and words we don't use on the air. Wouldn't you think?
Oh, could you bleep that out?
What you said was fine. I stopped myself from taking it to the next level. We all know those couple of missing letters. But wouldn't you think that at some point, calling your employer names that are going to reflect badly when other people see it might be something that an employer should be able to take action against?
Well, so this is considered activity. They were talking about the terms and conditions of employment. They weren't getting paid. So maybe the employer could discipline them for the language use, but not firing them. And they would also have to show that they had a pattern and practice of actually disciplining people for improper language use. Go ahead. Because we all know that most people don't get disciplined for using curse words these days, except when they use it for biased reasons, like telling me as a female that they don't like to hear me curse, and then I tell them, piss off. But is that going to get bleeped out? You have to really show you do discipline people for that behavior.
What about other behavior, like flipping off the president's motorcade and in just finding that your picture is published everywhere? Is that something?
So that's the Julie Briskman versus Aikman LLC case. And then Julie was caught in a picture by the president's photo staff, flipping off the Trump at the time. She was identified and then terminated. She brought a wrongful termination case against her employer. The case was actually settled, so we don't actually get to see what ultimately happened. But she was offered many jobs by people who felt for her in their heart. She could have argued that was outside of work political activity.
I mean, of all the conduct that we've talked about tonight, I can't think of a better example of purely political activity.
Right. And, you know, there can be gestures or imagery that can be deemed political. So even though that was a hand movement, that could be considered as political speech in that context. Although I think that a case could have gone either way, frankly, in terms of if that employer, I understand, had connections with the federal government. They were a government contractor. And so they did have an argument that her conduct could have impacted their ability to obtain business or otherwise impeded their workplace. So I think that one would have been an interesting one to watch to see whether or not that would have been construed as political speech. I think that was an image that was seen around the world. I think many people considered that political. I personally did. But I could see that could have gone either way. It would have been interesting to see how a judge would have called those balls or strikes.
And, of course, the individuals in that case had every reason in the world to settle it, so they don't want us to find out. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've been discussing protests and the workplace, labor and employment law in an increasingly unsettled and evolving world. Our guests tonight have been Beth W. Mora of Mora Employment Law and Wendy Mussel of Wendy Mussel PC. Tonight's show was produced by Beth Mora. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, where we will feature our discussion of landlord-tenant law. And best of all, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guests and the Labor Employment Section of the California Lawyer Association. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Tarek Ansari, I am Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.